Over the weekend, police in the conservative Indonesian province of Aceh raided several beauty salons run by transgender women. In the last several years, Indonesia's queer community has become increasingly vilified by politicians, religious leaders, and the wider community. As legislators draft significant changes to the criminal code, many are asking if things are only to get worse. Earlier today, I asked Hendry Yulius, research associate from Sydney University's Indonesian Studies Department, about the proposed changes.
Since 2016, there has been a number of efforts to criminalize LGBT people or homosexual identity or also homosexual practices. And then last year, an Islamic pro-family group proposed the amendment of the criminal code to include consented same-sex relation as a crime. But the Constitutional Court rejected that proposal, arguing that the responsibility should be with the House of Representatives, not with the Constitutional Court. So now the ball is heading to the House of Representatives. But at the same time, we are also witnessing the increasing attempts from those conservatives to keep pursuing these legal changes. So criminal code is one thing. We still have, for example, the broadcasting law to purge LGBT-related content from television.
So what is the likelihood of them actually passing into law?
Well, it's unpredictable, I have to say. But after the incident of the arrest of transgender woman in Aceh, I have been personally witnessing the increasing politicization of these issues by local and national politicians. So if this politicization worked, it's more likely that they can pass it into law.
So if the laws pass, how could life change for Indonesia's queer community?
Okay, so this is also very ambiguous and quite difficult to pin down, because how do you accuse people of being a homosexual unless you see them showing affections or having sex in front of you, right? So in a way that what I am worrying now is that the primary marker of LGBT people is going to be signified through their gender non-normativity. For example, men with female feminine mannerisms or transgender women. So they might be easily arrested because they are very visible.
On a number of fronts, Indonesia has become increasingly hostile to LGBT people, specifically in the last few years. Why now? Especially in what has historically been a comparatively liberal Muslim nation.
There are multiple elements here. The first important thing is the democratization of Indonesia since 1998 has led to the rising religious conservatism in the country. Democratization doesn't necessarily lead to the improvement of human rights, but in Indonesia case, ironically, it gives more power to religious conservatism to influence public and political spheres. That's number one. Number two, the issue of LGBT identity and rights have also been globalized and internationalized within this time frame. So, you know, like same-sex marriage in the U.S. was legalized in 2015, and it also caused uproar. And after that, LGBT issues also became national attention, creating national crackdown over LGBT Indonesia. And this is also because, yeah, the increasing visibilities of LGBT issues, the globalization of LGBT issues and marriage equality, which then gives political capital for the religious conservatives to politicize it, yeah, through the moral panic.
Speaking about our neighbor, one of our nearest neighbors, what does it mean for Australia, having a nation so nearby that is turning away from internationally recognized human rights?
Well, in Australia, we Yes Vote won last year. And this is a groundbreaking move for Australia, but I believe that marriage equality is not the end and shouldn't be the end of queer movements. So now I think we have to also feel more concerned about Indonesia and also take refugees, particularly queer refugees issues, very, very importantly. Yeah, I'm quite worried that queer refugees can become another important issue for Australia.
Research Associate Hendry Julius from the University of Sydney ending that report. The government continued its New Year announcements with today's innovation report, which seemed to also tie in with the new defence export strategy for military hardware that it announced yesterday. This report has been touted as Innovation 2.0, the second generation. And Roderick Chambers asked UTS Associate Professor Danielle Logue just how much substance there was behind the hype.
Well, we certainly needed something to go beyond the hashtag ideas boom, and it is good to see the government putting innovation and science to an extent back on the table and thinking about how do we better organise for innovation across different sectors.
I think Dr. Ferris was quite interested in the export capabilities as a way to economic growth. Is there anything new in this, though?
I think we have focused on export capabilities for many years now. We have a lot of support through our traditional Austrade services. The issue that we found in researching high-growth firms across the country is actually finding talent for them. So it's not accessing the markets that's an issue. It's the talent back here in Australia that they need to grow and scale their business. It is the challenge for them.
I was listening to Christopher Pine, I think, yesterday, explaining that banks were perhaps not the best people to finance new innovative projects for defence. And he suggested that's why the government should be involved. Is this the way we've always done it?
I think this is a really important point, Rod, and something that stuck out to me in the report, that the emphasis is on relying on the business sector to drive investment in research and development. And the report looks at the government's not really increasing R&D expenditure, mainly by 0.01%, and it's relying on business investment in R&D to increase from 1% to about 1.7% of GDP. And we know, as Christopher Pine says, that business just doesn't take that deeper investment in R&D. We know from Apple, we know from Tesla, big corporations, that a lot of those moonshot ideas and the deep science that we even find in our iPhone comes out of government-funded R&D that wouldn't have happened if we were relying on business to take that early stage risk in the scientific process.
I mean, a lot of the R&D funding sort of went through tax cuts and things. But that kind of assumes that you're making money to start with, which is often the wrong way round for when you're coming up with something new, isn't it?
That's right. What is missing in this document is that first level of scientific research that all economies really rely on and that businesses rely on to then commercialise and have products and services coming out of that. So we're not seeing any increase in that funding there. There's no emphasis on science, and this also kind of flies in the face of the impending university cuts that we're expecting to in R&D. So if we don't have a focus on, you know, university research, scientific research, our CSIRO, our national agencies there, there's not that capability to then look at how business can then commercialise and take it on from there. There's a problem in our pipeline.
And I think Christopher Pine, in his previous portfolio of education, was quite keen on STEM subjects, which I think the S stands for science, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I think we've missed our science minister is now out of the main cabinet as well. So it's kind of conflicting priorities that are going on here. But I do think it's a weakness to just think that an innovation capability for the nation can rely on business, increasing business investment in R&D. And still what we have here as our main policy for that is the R&D tax incentive for business R&D. We do have in the new document a focus on national missions and being the healthiest country in the world, to start have some focus there. Now, whilst I applaud having this idea of mission-oriented innovation policy, and that's been a lot of the work that's coming out of the UK and Europe at the moment, you've got to have that funded, actually. Otherwise, it's a little bit of an ideas boom again.
Yes, because, I mean, it is, if you're wanting to start exporting somewhere or to open up a new market in the traditional sense, it is good to have, you know, someone on the other side of the world that is a friendly face, that has an office, that it's somewhere where you can sort of land on, a landing pad.
That's right.
We've had that in the past, but are you saying that they've all been scaled back?
No, I think we still have that. We still have our Oz Trade and Oz Industry and our services programs like that. We also have the entrepreneurial launch pads for startups, where Aussie startups can go into Berlin, for example, and have 2 weeks of a free co-working space if you get into particular programs there. So,
is that working well in your experience?
I think the launch pads are a good way for startups to gain entry into those markets, but often startups at those early stages, they're still trying to work out what they're actually doing. What I was hoping we would see more of is that focus on missions and actually the government picking areas that we are going to have some deep long-term investment in, which then different industries can get behind. So you have that security of knowing this is where Australia is going, these 10 particular areas, this is what we're going to be known for, and we're going to invest in that and be globally competitive.
Dr. Danielle Logue, Associate Professor of Management Discipline Group at the University of Technology, Sydney, there ending that report.